case this morning, and that is 145 Fifth, Thursday, Pickland. I see Mr. Cronauer and Mr. Reeses. Can you hear me?
Yes,
Judge Surrey.
All right, thank you very much. Then we can proceed. Mr. Cronauer.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. On behalf of Mr. Reese and myself, Your Honor, thank you for giving us this chance to engage with you virtually. I know we both appreciate it. So as you're aware, Your Honor, the briefing in this case always started with a historical perspective. And that's because, as the saying goes, those who don't know history are destined to repeat it, which is why the Supreme Court in Boyd set forth in case law the principle obsta principis. And what that means is, as no doubt you're aware from reading the briefs, you nip the shoots of arbitrary power in the bud, because that's the only maxim which can ever preserve the liberties of any people. Due to this concern, Judge, the Constitution protects against the arbitrary power of a state or local government and the abuse of that power, and necessitates that claimants have a remedy in federal court when free speech is abused and unabashed favoritism determines the winners and the losers for government entitlements.
Well, we have a problem procedurally up front here, Mr. Cronauer, and that is that this was not litigated as a free speech claim, retaliation claim in the district court. It was litigated as an access to the court's retaliation claim.
Judge, I disagree. I know that was what the court relied on in Bridges, and we talked about that in the brief. And there is no, if you look at the paragraph 139 of the complaint, there is no claim that the court access was denied. The court relied upon that in Bridges. But when you read Bridges, Bridges has two claims, retaliation for accessing the courts.
Your case, not Bridges. Your case wasn't litigated as a free speech retaliation claim in the district court. It was litigated as a access to the court's retaliation claim. You've shifted your theory on appeal.
No, Judge, I would disagree. And there's nowhere in the complaint that states we were denied access to the courts.
Well, that's how you litigated the First Amendment retaliation claim at summary judgment. At the dismissal motion, the 12B6 motion. I looked at your response, and it was purely a claim of retaliation, denial of access to the courts based on your naming of the DeKalb city manager as a witness in an unrelated litigation at his prior employment.
Correct, Judge. That was the allegation, that because he was disclosed in this other litigation as a witness for the voicemail and the email, that was the retaliation. So by definition, we are in court, we're accessing court, the access and the disclosure in court was the retaliation.
Right. I get that was the claim as it was originally brought, as it was litigated at 12B6. And my point is that your emphasis on free speech retaliation shifts the theory on appeal, and you can't do that. So you have to stick with what you litigated below.
I guess I would answer to that, Judge, assuming that's true. From a 12B6 motion perspective, you go through all the pleading precedent, which you're familiar with. I mean, if there is a chance to cure that, then we should be given that chance to amend, which we could easily do and I'd be willing to do. And I think that's the other problem with the district court order that our briefs address. And that would, I think, obviate the concern about what was actually pled in the First Amendment complaint.
Well, did you submit a new complaint with a different set of claims?
No, Judge, because once the dismissal order was entered with prejudice, I don't have that right. I have to somehow go in, either get the district court to reconsider, or I appeal, and I chose to appeal. But to Judge, under the, even if you were to find that the denial of access claim was what was litigated, even under the equal protection claim, the same facts are relevant to an equal protection claim, and that's under the Ishmael case that's talked about in Swanson, Hilton, this court's case, Willowbrook, and that is, if there is an illegitimate animus, that in and of itself violates equal protection. So even if you want to ignore or disregard the First Amendment retaliation claim, the equal protection claim would also cure or remedy any concerns.
The extent to which illegitimate animus is an element the class of one equal protection claim in this circuit is a little uncertain because of the state of our case law on that. But what we do know is that if there's a rational basis for the city's actions, or I guess we don't have the city in the appeal anymore because the city was the defendant only on the state law claim. So all we have is Mr. Nicholas, the city manager. If there was a rational basis for what he did, which is to say make the recommendation that this TIF financing be withdrawn, then you lose. And there appears on the face of it to be ample rational basis because of the lack of financial wherewithal or experience in hotel development on your client's part.
But Judge, the problem is that presumes what was being said is not defamatory. And under Chaplinsky,
well, we're not here on a defamation claim, that's a state law claim. We're here on a constitutional claim.
Agreed, but under the Constitution, a rational basis, so under the Miller case, if you have an objective reason that can be verified, maybe there's a rational basis. This is a subjective, alleged to be untrue, incorrect, in no way, shape, or form true. By definition, it has to be irrational from a pleading stage. Now, if we get a summary judgment and they can come up with some certain facts or something, that's a different analysis, Judge. But for purposes of 12b6, the court has to take as true the allegations that the statements were false. And that's under Grady. The Grady case talks about a public media campaign to tarnish and harass. There's case law that talks about not keeping the information contained to where it's supposed to be. I mean, going to the media, doing radio interviews, trying to tarnish an individual can never be a rational basis, Judge. Now, the Miller case, the court cites, dealt with asbestos. And that's, if you want to take a big picture why this case is much different than Miller, the issue here is not that the project had problems. The issue was that the manager, the defendant, went after the project's principals, themselves rather than the project. That's a big difference because now we're getting into subjective untruths, Judge, that by definition have to be irrational at the pleading stage.
Well, the plaintiff here, your client is the LLC. It's not you. Right. You're the principal that we're talking about here. So
one of the two, correct, Judge?
Right. And you're the lawyer who named Mr. Nicholas as a witness in the unrelated case before the plaintiff LLC was even formed, as I understand the chronology here. And
that
so you
correct,
have to stick to what Mr. Nicholas did to the 145 Fisk LLC.
Well, because the retaliation doesn't look at when was the timing for retaliation is when did the
LLC wasn't involved in the previous court action, was not seeking access to the court. It wasn't even in existence then. So there's at a minimum, a serious causation problem here with your retaliation argument.
So, Judge, I would argue then that that's the issue again. If that's basically what you're raising, a standing issue, we should get leave to amend and we can put in the agents rather than the plaintiff LLC if that's the court's concern. Again, these are issues that can be cured.
The agents don't have a claim because the agreement that was terminated, the agreement regarding the TIF financing, was between the city and the LLC, not between the city and you and your partner.
Correct, Judge, which is why the plaintiff LLC is named and why the case law is clear that LLCs can only act through their agents, through their employees, which is why.
Right. That's the point. I mean, you said you wanted leave to amend so that you could name yourself as a plaintiff along with the other principal, your partner in this failed project. That would be futile, is the point, because the agreement wasn't between the city and you. It was between the city and your LLC.
True, Judge. But again, the retaliation occurred against the plaintiff because of the plaintiff's connection to the principals. And under the agency case law, the retaliation case law, it's broad and includes lots of different behavior and people rather than just the individual being retaliated against.
This is not a question of agency law. Agency law has to do with the extent to which a principal might be liable for the torts of its agents or the extent to which agents can act for their principals. We don't have any of those issues here. We've got a set of constitutional claims by an LLC that lost a development opportunity because of insufficient wherewithal to see it through, according to the city manager.
Correct, which is alleged to be false, which needs to be taken, considered true for this stage of pleading. So Judge, maybe this will help cure your qualms. So the other issue or equal protection is favoritism. And the Lake Forest case, the district court cited, talks about this. Kelo talks about this. A court confronted with a plausible accusation of impermissible favoritism of private parties should treat the objection as a serious one and review the record to see if it has merit. So even if you want to agree with the district court that the retaliation claim should be dismissed, under Kelo, under Lake Forest, the favoritism issue with Chaudine, which with Pappas, absolutely raises an equal protection claim that should survive at the very least through discovery.
Kelo wasn't an equal protection case. The Fifth Amendment takings clause public purpose case.
Right. Kelo was, but Lake Forest was not. Lake Forest was an equal protection claim. In Kelo, I'm saying for purposes of analogy, when you're in essence giving government funds to try to rebuild blighted areas, that is similar to development at issue in Kelo. So when you look at the facts that are alleged, you've got the defendant manager comes in the first week in office, he's meeting with Chaudine to do a hotel development, the same company he was meeting with years prior trying to do a private public joint venture with. And you also have alleged that as soon as he successfully released false information about the plaintiff and its principals, he then the next day had an agenda to redirect the TIF money to his friend, confidant, Pappas Development, which also contained an investor that had hired Mr. Nicholas to lobby local governments. I think under the Lake Forest.
Kevin claimed, Mr. Kronauer, that 145 Fifth, the LLC, had any experience in hotel development. Have you?
To be honest, Judge, I believe that we said the way it was alleged, they said we don't have experience in hotel development. I said that was false. If you're talking about me personally, I'm different than the principal. The other principal in this case absolutely does.
Are you standing before the court claiming that you made a good faith allegation or that you are now arguing that 145 Fisk has experience in hotel development?
So I'm trying to be very specific. The principals, yes. 145 Fisk, as you know, is a holding company developed for this purpose. So 145 Fisk itself was a shell company started just for this project. The principals underlining that project, yes, I'm very comfortable with representations of the court.
So 1456 Fisk has no experience in hotel development. This is an utterly new venture.
145 Fisk has experience through its principals, which is an extension of agency.
So you and your partner are the principals and you're contending and arguing right now that you have experience in hotel development. And therefore your LLC does.
My partner does.
Was that allegation an argument made in the district court?
It can be. If that's the concern and the amendment needs to be made, that can be made. The way it was approached is that the statement was made and it was false. And the public statements at issue here didn't even deal with experience. It dealt with working capital, financial wherewithal, which we also allege were false. So the opposite of something being false, Judge, is obviously that it must be true.
Well, and just asserting that it's false is not really enough here. I'm asking whether there were good faith and plausible allegations in the complaint or any argument at 12b-6 that 145 Fisk had financing and working capital to back this hotel development project, as well as hotel development experience.
Absolutely, Judge.
My understanding is that there were no such plausible allegations made, that this was a completely new venture for both this shell corporation and you and your partner?
Judge, so the allegations talk about how the defendant was able to talk to at least one banker, the banker he chose, and that banker told him that there is sufficient capital, don't worry about it, they're credible. And despite that conversation occurring, as a matter of fact, the next day or weeks or whatever it was, the timing comes out and says something totally opposite and false, despite his conversation with a banker.
But you're acknowledging there was no working capital.
I'm not acknowledging that.
Corporation.
The working capital from a shell corporation is from the principals, which the defendant knows because he was trying to do the same thing. There's absolutely working capital. And if that's the issue, then we can amend and we can add all those allegations to try to refute the false narrative being perpetuated by the defendant.
All right. I see your time has expired. We'll move to Mr. Reeses.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Michael Reeses, and I'm here today on behalf of the defendant appellee, William Nicholas. The district court properly granted the Rule 12b6 motion to dismiss counts 2, 3, and 9 of the First Amendment complaint. The district court should be affirmed. Count 2 was a claim for First Amendment retaliation. The crux of the claim is that Nicholas retaliated against the LLC in 2019 after its attorney member disclosed Nicholas as a witness in unrelated litigation in 2017. The district court properly dismissed count 2 because 145 Fisk was not a party to the earlier litigation and it was not exercising a right of court access when Nicholas was named as a witness in the earlier litigation. 145 Fisk was not even formed until late 2018 for real estate investment purposes unrelated to the earlier litigation. It has no claim that has been denied a right of access as a result of its attorney member's representation of a different litigant in 2017. In short, the LLC itself engaged in no protected First Amendment activity. 145 Fisk's claim is based only on a denial of access to the courts. As Judge Sykes indicated, you have to stick with the claim that you actually litigated. It has abandoned that claim, however, on appeal. Instead, for the first time on appeal, it claims that it is a claim based on a right of free speech. This new argument is completely at odds with its own pleadings in paragraphs 93 through 97 of the First Amendment complaint. Specifically, paragraph 93 starts out, "The First Amendment right to petition the government for the redress of grievances extends to the courts in general and is protected activity." All of the allegations in count 2 refer only to the prior litigation. Paragraphs 93 through 97 refer to the prior case, which did not involve 145 Fisk and the right of access to the courts. It is, frankly, disingenuous for 145 Fisk to posture that it is really making a free speech claim when it never used those words anywhere in those paragraphs. This court should reject the attempt to change theories on appeal. Well, we heard something this morning about a motion to amend. Let's be very clear. 145 Fisk never filed a motion to amend, and it never made any proposed amendment of record. We never had notice of any such amendment, but even if 145 Fisk had filed such a motion before or after judgment, and it made the election to appeal rather than to go back to the district court and make a record, the amendment would have been futile. 145 Fisk never identified any protected free speech after it was formed in 2018. It relied only on the actions taken by its attorney member on behalf of a different litigant in unrelated litigation in 2017. We heard nothing this morning on count 3 that relates to the denial of due process. I just very briefly want to talk about that. The district court properly held that count 3 did not state a claim for due process two reasons. One, it could not allege a protectable property interest because it had no ownership or possessory interest in the property. It alleged in paragraph 103 only that it had a contract to purchase. However, a contract to purchase, an option to purchase, is a contract right. It is not a property right in the constitutional sense. The mere opportunity to acquire property is not a protected property interest. We cited United States versus Swan in our brief specifically, and plaintiff has cited no case to the contrary. Count three did not state a claim for a plausible violation of due process regarding property in which 145 Fisk held no constitutionally protected property interest. The second reason why 145 Fisk had no protected property interest is because the preliminary development agreement was not a guarantee, but it was hedged with many conditions precedent and contingencies, making its interest uncertain. After all, the agreement was only preliminary, and it was subject to a final agreement for consideration and approval at a later time, which never happened. Plaintiff could not be deprived of a property interest when it had no property interest under the preliminary development agreement. Finally, let's talk about equal protection. On count nine, Fisk failed to state a claim for a violation of equal protection. To state a claim, plaintiff had to allege facts to show that a government official intentionally discriminated against it without a rational basis. The burden was on Fisk, and a rational basis is presumed. Plaintiff did not meet that burden here for two reasons. First, plaintiff did not identify any identical or directly comparable hotel redevelopment comparator for TIF funding. Although plaintiff complains of favoritism, the pleadings identify no directly comparable hotel redevelopment project that was the beneficiary of TIF funding. Actually, the complaint identifies two different hotel development projects, the Calab 2020 and a second one, University Commons. However, neither of those hotel projects ever received TIF funding. So for all of plaintiff's claims of favoritism, the fact is that of the three hotel developments, none of them got any TIF funding. Plaintiff does not allege otherwise. Second, the district court was entitled to conclude that there was a conceivable rational basis for termination of the preliminary development agreement. Judge Sykes was certainly correct when she said that there was an ample basis for termination. 145 Fisk is a shell. It had no working capital, and it was dependent on TIF funding and lender financing for the project. Even if plaintiff's claim of animosity and favoritism is taken at face value, the pleadings show that the city was proceeding cautiously in not committing TIF funding to any proposed hotel development project. And I want to emphasize, and maybe this is because of a global pandemic, maybe it's because but the point is that any hotel development project carries financial risks. Risks that I think are only underscored when you have a pandemic. Certainly that could not be foreseen. But remember, then when we're talking about a rational basis, we're only talking about what was conceivable. And I do not think that the city's decision should be second-guessed when the fact of the matter is that no hotel development project has received TIF funding and any hotel project is or carries a financial risk. If there are no questions, we would ask that the district court dismissal of counts 2, 3, and 9 be affirmed with prejudice in their entirety. If there are no further questions, thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Reeses. Mr. Cronauer, your time had expired. You may have 1 minute to offer some concluding thoughts.
I apologize, Judge. I thought we had 5 minutes for rebuttal. No?
You used it all.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I thought coming up at 10. Basically, Judge, just briefly, page 3 of 34, page ID 473, my brief before the district court arguing the dismissal motion, said that having an element is not denial of access to the courts. Denial of access to the court is not an element of plaintiff's First Amendment retaliation claim, and I cited Woodruff. If that was the confusion, Judge, again, I think leave to amend, we can easily cure that. As far as the due process claim, Judge, there's the Alchemy case, which talks about due process arises from statutes, resolutions, regulations. Clearly, we have that in this case with the TIF Act being earmarked pursuant to an official DeKalb resolution, which required that that resolution be fulfilled as passed. And for, I think the court to, again, take the defendant's statements as true, despite a 2-year prior work history between the city and the plaintiffs, again, undermines any rational basis, because it doesn't make common sense under Swanson that 2 years later, all of a sudden money has become an issue. And I think to argue now with COVID, obviously I'd move to strike that, Judge, because COVID, it can't be a valid reason now, and there's nothing in the record to support that. So thank you for your time, Judge. Appreciate
your consideration. Thank you very much. This is taken under advisement. And